Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Sneha Navarapu, the host of this channel. Today, I have the pleasure and honor of being in conversation with Kareem Khubchandani, the author of the exciting new book, Ishtail, Accenting Gay Indian Nightlife. This book was published by the University of Michigan Press, and it dropped less than a month ago. Either way, it's very, very hot off the press and has a really popping book cover, I might add. Kareem Khubchandani is Mellon Bridge Assistant Professor of Theatre, Dance and Performance Studies and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Tufts University. Welcome to the show, Kareem. So glad you could take time out to chat with me today.
Thank you, Sneha. I'm super excited to be here. I love your scholarship and I feel really lucky to be in conversation with you.
Well, let me congratulate you on your first book, and what a book this is. Very few academic books are page turners, and this certainly is one of them. Wow. Some parts of the book were actually so vivid that I felt like I was watching a film. So again, major congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Well, I thought we could start off with getting to know you a little bit better. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about your journey into academia.
Sure. Academia was never sort of an aspiration or a goal. It wasn't part of my life plan, I guess, when I was a younger person. When I finished college, during college, I was very scared to leave the sciences behind. I wanted to be a chemical engineer. And then I was like, well, I'm more of a humanities person, so let me go to psychology because it's still a science. And then I went to education because it's, applicable and there's a job that it would lead to. And I ended up as a sociology and anthropology major, but I still couldn't commit to the arts. And I ended up working as an administrator at a small liberal arts college. And just to pass the time, I would choreograph for the South Asian students there. And a performance studies professor there, Bertha Hotar, she said to me, you know what you do is performance studies, because I was making shows like, I call them Legally Brown or Brokeback Bollywood.
Right.
But she was seeing what I was doing and she said, you know, there's theory behind performance. And I was like, I don't understand. And she said, well, you can go to school and figure it out. but I don't come from a family of academics. My parents, one of my parents finished high school, the other didn't. So I didn't have this familiarity with what academia entailed other than having gone to college myself. So, you know, I entered grad school just to learn more out of curiosity to think about Bollywood and queerness and nightlife. And that's where the book comes out of my dissertation project. And I sort of ended up in academia by a happy accident and through someone's advice and a lot of mentoring and coaching. And yeah, and I guess I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really interesting journey into academia, if I may say so myself.
From Bollywood choreography to, to writing a book, you know. Yeah,
that is very unique. It's the first that I've heard of something like this. But I was hoping that you could tell us how the book was conceived then, and what's the story of the book?
So The field site I had thought about writing about for the book when I wrote my application to graduate school was New York. In New York, there's a party called Desilicious, and it was the first time I'd gone to a queer Bollywood night when I was 19 years old. And I used to go to those parties often, and I was really moved by the drag performances that happened there. And so that even though I went to school in Chicago, I was thinking, okay, I'm going to be moving from middle of nowhere New England to Chicago, and I will be surrounded by queer South Asians, and there'll be a nightlife scene, and that'll be the place. And there wasn't one when I got there. There was an organization just forming called Tricon, and Tricon Chicago. It's sort of a franchise of a Bay Area organization. And they said, hey, we need to start a fundraiser because they were a brand new organization. I was like, yeah, let's throw a party like they do in New York. And they said, okay, you organize it. And I said, and we have to have drag queens. And I couldn't find one, so I became one. At that first party, I went to the closest makeup store by my house and bought whatever I could. And I ended up, in whiteface, basically. and bought a cheap wig and did Bidi Jalile, and I did MIA's Paper Planes, trying to appeal to multiple audiences. But what came out of that was, organizing the party, performing in drag really situated how I created a field site for me and situated how I looked at the field from the position of the organizer and performer, as opposed to an attendee, as I would have if I had been looking at Desilicious. So that's where one field site was sort of developed. But the other thing that happened was, when I started talking to my friends who were coming to these parties, they would say, it's so great that we can do this, and we can be here, we can be together, and we can be in drag and have all this fun, and of course, it's so sad they don't have that in India. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, I'm sure it's there. my parents live in Bangalore. They retired in Bangalore. And on visiting them, I've seen like on apps that there are ads, people messaging me with ads about like a party or something like that. So I went to Bangalore and found that there's a really fantastic scene there. But what finally emerged out of all of that, of moving across borders, was that I was running into some of the same people at the parties. Mm-hmm. I was actually, I'd see them in Toronto and then I'd see them in Bombay, or I'd see them in Hyderabad and I'd see them in Chicago. Or I'd be in Chicago and someone would say, hey, my roommate is actually coming to do a training there. Can you take him out? So the book ended up being a transnational study of this global professional class, mm-hmm. and how queer men use nightlife as a place to explore politics, to be inside of politics, to rearrange aesthetics and politics simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the book is, for our listeners who may have not gotten a chance to read the book yet, the book is a rich ethnographic exploration of performances of cultural differences in gay nightlife spaces in Chicago, Bangalore, and other global cities, as Kareem has just told us himself. And very persuasively, you show how the nightlife is a productive window into how political economies live in and on the body. But before we get into the meat of the chapters, let's start with the most pressing question of all, one that grounds your book conceptually. What does the title of the book mean? What is Ishtail?
Ishtail, so it's a word I grew up hearing, and it's basically accented style. It's the way some Indian people would pronounce style. Mm-hmm. And, that might be in South India, that might sound more like style or estyle. So Ishtail is a sort of a Bombay version of that accenting, but it has its own currency. And when we used it as kids and how it's used in public culture is to name that kind of excessive performance. Mm-hmm. The overexertion we make in order to achieve dominant style, global style, that kind of aspirational embodiment that we're supposed to have. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking about Ishtail on its own terms as a South Asian idiom to mean that excessive performance of modernity, but also thinking about it as accented style. So I can think about how the accent becomes a way of analyzing cultural difference across a number of scales, because our accents change when we move, you know. The same accent can signify a city, a region, a country, a continent, you know. It becomes a scalar analytic to think about how cultural difference changes in context. So, you know, in one of the chapters, I'm thinking about South India as a region, but in another context, I'm thinking about Indianness in the white spaces of gay neighborhoods in Chicago. So the accent allows me to think about how people perform their style in these different ways, or how it comes to be. And the other thing is that the accent works both ways. It really is about performance. It's, you know, you're not always conscious that you have one, but other people hear it. They hear something inside your voice, right? So it becomes this way of thinking about performance and how meaning is actually constituted between people, as opposed to in sort of an ontological sense.
Yeah.
So that's how I could think about Ishtayal, is really on its own terms as the South Asian way of capturing the excesses of trying to be a modern subject that we see in Bollywood and Tollywood and Kollywood, that we hear in terms like fobbiness, but then also thinking about the accent as a useful analytic across regions and spaces.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Thank you. In the first chapter, you explore the category of the Indian techie in the context of weekly Saturday night parties, and you already mentioned that you're looking at this transnational professional class. And you show very beautifully how these weekly parties are implicated into the aspirational ethos of Silicon Valley-esque Bangalore, and how the party planners in the landscape of software engineers and MNC workers try to create gay atmospheres that mimic a certain hegemonic understanding of queer pleasures. But you also walk us through repeated refusals by those who attend these parties, and I guess how they perform these repeated refusals through Ishtayal. Would you be open to sharing a couple of examples from the chapter that capture these tensions in the every nightlife in Bangalore?
I love this question. So the scene that opens the chapter is a New Year's Eve party, and the flyer announces that they're going to be go-go boys wearing brand label underwear. And of course, these, you know, at the party, the lights come on, and it's these horrible fluorescent lights, but they clear the stage of people dancing, and they bring on these supposedly straight men who are wearing bathrobes, and they show off, they take off their bathrobes, and they've got leopard print underwear on, but they're so nervous to be there, and and they're, you know, they're light skinned and hairless and muscular, and, you know, of course, what people want to see. But they're so nervous, and they just disappear off the stage very, very quickly. And then seconds later, someone else, just a party attendee, runs out from the bathroom wearing a red women's bathing suit. And he's this dark skinned, skinny person. And just the contrast of his femininity, his dark skin, his body not having that sort of muscular build, really stands in contrast, right? And it brings into relief the normativity that the go-go boys are trying to produce. And then also the song that's played right after that was the song Chikni Chameli had just been released, and people went wild for it, but all these like fat men got on stage, or fat and like non-muscular bodies got on stage, and some of them ripped their shirts open, you know, inspired by the go-go boys, but they didn't have those bodies. And just the ways that dark skin, fat fat bodies, feminine clothing, accent, and come into friction with really the normative gay body was one of those moments. So that's at one end of the chapter. At the other end of the chapter is a party that was commemorating the shooting in Orlando at Pulse Nightclub during a Latinx night. And the party was titled Love is Love. And so Love is Love is the most mainstream way of sort of performing gay rights. It's Lin-Manuel Miranda saying Love is Love is Love. It's just, it's so wishy-washy in some ways. Mm-hmm. But they had said in the invitation to that party that there will be a moment of silence. And the problem is that at this party, there was no way to achieve a moment of silence because of where the party was, and because the mic system was really bad, and because at these parties the DJs often overuse the mic, so people just are used to ignoring anything that someone on the mic is saying. So, right. So again, this is one of those moments that it's supposed to look like that mourning of a that somber moment that mourns something that happened in the U.S., but in this context, it just can't happen. And there's, while I was at that party, I opened Grindr, and someone had a torso picture. And again, it wasn't a muscular torso, but he had a torso picture, and it said, "V are all Orlando." Instead of W-E, it was the letter V, right? And again, that's the accent showing itself, right? He's performing his attachment to this global gay sensibility, but the slippage between we and V suggests that there's always an accent at play that doesn't allow for a smooth performance of that dominant cosmopolitan queerness.
Yeah, that's so beautifully put. And I love that you gave us the two examples that really bookend the chapter and bring out the range of the sorts of attachments and refusals at play. So thanks for that. Chapter two, which was, by the way, my favorite, shifts the focus from this transnational imaginaries to the local and regional politics. The chapter very persuasively decenters Section 377, the law that has often anchored legal conversation around the queer Indian movement. In this chapter, instead, you show how the ban on social dance enforced in Bangalore from 2006 to 14 shaped nocturnal socialities. Could you share with our listeners how and why paying attention to the ban on social dancing enhances our understanding of queer citizenship in India and beyond?
Yeah. So I'll start with 377 very briefly and just say that, you know, the 377 is the statute against sodomy that and that has been at the center of India's LGBT rights movement and has gotten the most publicity as activists and lawyers argued against keeping it in the penal code. But day to day, the way that LGBT life is policed and specifically by the state is through the healthcare system or when and who can get surgeries and who is cared for by their doctors and discriminated on because they have sex with people of the same gender, or it's through laws like harassment laws or public indecency laws. So there's an example of activists handing out flyers about safer sex, and they were accused of sexual harassment. Or hijras are often accused of kidnapping when they take in young people into their hijra kinship systems. So it's not necessarily through 377, but it's through all these other legal formations that LGBT people are policed. So I think in general, it's important to decenter 377 as the way we think about the relationship between law and LGBTQ subjects in India. The ban on dancing was something that emerged out of Karnataka and Bangalore's specific anxiety around the trafficking of women into dance bars. And it was a moral panic, and we understand that moral panics work on discourse and not necessarily on truth about people being trafficked. These were women who were migrating from different parts of India into Bangalore, and it created these anxieties around who are these women performing sexually for men in public spaces like dance bars. And so there was a ban on dancing instituted, a ban on social dancing, so you could still go to concerts and such. But that comes to affect gay men's access to pleasure. But it also affects various kinds of sex workers and transgender dancers and cisgender women migrants. So moving to think about the ban on dance instead of 377 suddenly puts gay men who love to party, who are getting a lot of pleasure and reparative joy from dancing, as I try to demonstrate across the book, it puts these gay men in the same bracket with these other vulnerable subjects. And 377 isn't able to do the same thing. And so we start to, to use the sort of a common term, we start to think intersectionally about who is made vulnerable by the state by thinking about dance. The other thing that this chapter is trying to do is think about the law as an aesthetic practice. And this is something I'm taking from Joshua Chambers Lutzen and his book, A Race So Different. But there are people deciding when we're dancing. So dancing is not allowed at the nightclub, but the bar owner may come over and tell someone to stop bopping their hips or just stop shaking their shoulders. So people become arbiters of... When people can become arbiters of what is dance, they suddenly become arbiters of the law. And so the aesthetics and law, I think, have a really important relationship that's staged through the ban on social dance, because people can decide this is dance and this is not. And so I try to point to some of the ways that my interlocutors are working within these limits placed on their bodies to find pleasure and to be silly and to have a great time. But also always wrapping that story into, well, who else is affected by this law? And how can we think across more bodies, think about vulnerability across more bodies than just the gay men's claim to vulnerability?
Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thanks for that. I mean, I really enjoyed the chapter precisely because it does such a refreshing take, on law and vulnerability as you poignantly put it. The book is in three parts, and the first two chapters are the first part, and in the second part, you take us through the gay neighborhoods in Chicago, and you show us how your interlocutors become desirable, and in doing so, they complement and reify whiteness. You show us how South Asians performing racialized labor seem to make desirable homonormative partners. And we argue for the efficacy of thinking about oral narratives as performances. I was hoping you could tell us a little bit what thinking about oral narratives, performances, and desirability does to our understanding of interracial relations and sexuality.
Yeah. So broadly, that chapter is insisting on thinking about performance in interracial desire in three ways. One is that is what Greg Mitchell has called performative labor, that in enacting, in trying to stage desire, in trying to be attractive, that we invoke the performativity of our race and racial difference. You know, we tell people, oh, of course I watch Bollywood, in order for people to recognize that we mm-hmm. are in fact Indian, and we're the correct kind of Indian, and we will be a good attractive oriental partner for a nice white Midwestern man. You know, so that's the sort of performative labor, is that we're pulling on the force of history and symbolic meanings to stage our desirability. The second is also thinking about spaces of desire as stages. So and so thinking about what we stand around and with, and whom we're on stage with. So if a South Asian person is in the bar alone, they become racially ambiguous because they could be Latino or Arab or mixed race or. But if they're with other South Asians, if there are other bodies around us, suddenly the accent thickens. And of course, we're all Indian, and so we must be a certain way, right? So really thinking about the context in which the body is seen. And then lastly, I think about the oral narrative itself. And this is where, you know, I mean, I document so many moments where my interlocutors actually become undesirable. You know, someone smells like biryani, or someone has assumed that they're not going to be a good partner because they'll be forced into an arranged marriage. But if you actually listen to their stories, right, and I print their stories at length there, because I think there's really a sense of hope in a lot of them. And if not hope, there's always a sense of contradiction as well. So they'll critique the way South Asians behave, but then they'll also critique the way white people behave. Or they'll let their voice trail off to create some room for possibility, as opposed to foreclosing the fact that they might be the assumption that they might be undesirable. So I think just the interviews in themselves are doing a lot of work. And you know, coming out of performance studies, we understand that the interview is a performance, that mm-hmm. it matters who's asking the question, that you know, they've gotten to know me. So people would say, you remember that moment or that we did that thing. But I keep that in there to remind people that I've also developed a relationship with folks such that they're telling me these stories because it's me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe this is a good moment then to perhaps ask you a question I was going to ask you later. But it is true that when I was reading the book, I was struck by how enduring these like field relationships seemed, and how people opened up to you, you know, with a lot of detail, a lot of honesty. And I was wondering if you could tell us how these fieldwork relationships emerged, and how you were able to work with them, with these people, and whether you still hang out with them, whether you still talk to them.
Yeah, so there's a moment in which in one of the chapters I write about Bollywood actress Sridevi, and during the course of, or well after my field work, she passed away, but one of my interlocutors had really loves her. And when I landed back in India at one moment and I met up with this friend, he said, I can't believe, this is a year after Sridevi's death, he said, I can't believe you didn't call me when she died. No, this is that, you know, they are holding me accountable to the information that they've given me. And they know that I see how important these figures are in their life, for example. Mm-hmm. But the way we built that kind of relationship was by dancing together. And when I started fieldwork in India and spent a full year there, I was staying with my parents. I got involved with an LGBT support group, and Pride was coming up, and they said, "We want to dance, and we heard you're a dancer." So this is that anecdote about dancing at when I was at my job so long ago. It comes back to haunt me. But they said, we hear you're a dancer, and you have to choreograph for us. And I put out a call on Facebook, and we formed this group called the Pink Divas, and So dancing in the field became this way of really getting to know the divas that my friends like to listen to. They it gave me an understanding of their bodies in a particular way and the language with which they talked about their bodies. One of the things I did was, both in Bangalore and Chicago, I didn't do any interviews until I got to know people and until people knew who I was. So I was interviewing people I know. I didn't send any cold emails saying, "Hey, I am a researcher. I would like to interview people who fall into this category." So these were all folks that I knew and knew who I was, knew I had some kind of public persona as someone who made YouTube videos or did drag or danced or showed up at the parties. So they spoke to me about dance or about boys or about sex or any of those things, because those are the spaces in which they saw me as well. Mm-hmm. In Chicago, where I performed in drag regularly, drag was also this way of people coming up to me and saying, "I want to do it too," right? I became a mother to several of the people I interviewed. You know, so we have these intimate relationships. I became a drag mother to them. I helped them with wigs and makeup and so I really participated. And some of these friendships have been sustained. Some are, you know, just liking each other's pictures on Facebook. Some are still best friends. So it's a mix, but these are people who have stayed in my life, who I continue to offer advice to as a drag madam, I guess, a drag auntie in the community.
You know, as you were speaking, I was just thinking about, I've been working on these revise and resubmit edits, and one of my reviewers was very angry that I don't have numbers in my data and methods section. How long were your interviews? How did you, what was your introductory email reading like? And as you were saying, I didn't cold email people with this standard line. I was just, I couldn't help but laugh in my head. thank you for that. And you know, speaking of divas, it's in chapter 5, also a favorite, that you tell us how Bollywood queers us, and you show us how your interlocutors relate to Bollywood divas Sridevi and Madhuri on the dance floor, and how embodied reanimations of their songs and dances points to some kind of reparative labor performed by men who've been disciplined into respect, into what one might call respectable masculinities, whatever that means. I want you to say a little bit about this, and also about how understandings of respectability and aggressive femininity are negotiated on the dance floor.
You know, I think that the dance floor is a very disciplinary space. Mm-hmm. And we're constantly asked to not behave badly. I remember this moment. I was at a Desilicious party in New York, and I had recently come back from field work in Bangalore. And while I was there, I've always had dreams of learning Kathak. And so I was taking classes, and some song comes on at the party, and I start doing Kathak chakras. And so, you know, you're extending your arms out from your body to do those dances. And I nicely went and knocked one of the bouncers right in the stomach.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, he's standing there on the dance floor making sure no one's misbehaving. And I knocked him. And he literally grabbed my wrist and was dragging me out. And someone else grabbed my other hand, pulled me back into the crowd, and I disappeared into the crowd and got to stay at the party. But again, there's a particular way you're supposed to dance at the party. Mm-hmm. And the music is often telling you that. And so, you know, if they're playing a song like Make Some Noise for the Desi Boys, you're supposed to have that weighted, masculine, muscular performance. And then, of course, the movie that it's from has given you a visual cue of how what your body is supposed to look like, how you're supposed to move alongside that kind of music.
Yeah.
So what happens if you've got these rooms full of men and you start playing these campy, nostalgic songs of 80s divas, and what kinds of movements might it elicit? And I make the argument that these are the, for people of the age of, that I'm interviewing, you know, between 25 and 35 at the time that I was doing these interviews, they were between 10 and 15 in the 80s, and they were watching Madhuri Dixit and Sridevi on screen and mimicking them, but were often disciplined for those movements. And then they enter into the workspace and they enter into the nightclub, and again, they're being disciplined for their movements, and they're asked to be a certain kind of quote-unquote respectable masculinity, right? You're supposed to bring your body into public space in a very careful way in order to be desirable, in order to not offend others. But what happens when the refrain of one of Madhuri's songs comes on? Because it's not the song that they're going to play at the club, but if they do play it, what happens? How are you allowed to return to particular kinds of memories that you can have hold in the body? And so I work on this. I work on it at that individual level of people telling me stories about gender discipline, but also thinking about it at a political, economic level of asking what was going on in as the 80s transitioned into the 90s. That how was dance changing? How was femininity changing? What were these young people seeing on screen that was actually unique to that very point? How were these gestures actually very unique to that very point of cinema making? Such that those are the gestures that they held on to. Those are the gestures that feel very exciting to bring back into the nightclub. And what does that do? What frictions does that make when the nightclub aspires so much to masculinity? You know, people have asked me why is it not queer nightlife? And I'm like, because the spaces I write about really privilege men and masculinity, So femininity actually can be quite aggressive in those spaces. It can manifest and do as an accent, right? It comes into friction with the dominant understanding of what's supposed to happen in that space and can produce new worlds and fabulate new kinds of experiences.
Yeah. And I think in the chapter after, you delve into the role of class, region, and caste in performances in the nightclub, but also performances of femininity and this, I guess, this desire for what is called rawness. Mm-hmm. Could you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think I'll actually still talk about Madhuri and Sridevi. So But think about it through those terms of rawness, caste, class, region. So when the dances that stick right to their bodies are in fact regional and classed dances. So Sridevi is known for her snake dance, and that dance form borrows from that Saroj Khan choreographed for her borrows from belly dance, but it also borrows from Adivasi snake worship, right? So there's an otherness to the dance form. Similarly, when Madhuri Dixit performs her breast pulses midriff showing top in Choli Ke Piche in Khalnayak that a lot of people reenact in the nightclub, she's using the sort of bucolic sound of Rajasthan and to create a particular sexiness. And again, it's Ila Arun's raw voice, or what's described as a raw voice that produces the regional in that movement, right? So we see white drag queens doing this all the time, borrowing from the kind of the bumpkin aesthetic in order to create a different kind of femininity in the nightclub too. So really, I think, you know, when we think about what femininity feels sexy, makes us feel raw, or, you know, that it makes us feel like we're returning to some kind of rooted, innate, libidinal self, it's often the regional or affiliated with caste or affiliated with subordinate castes or tribal folks or poor folks, you know, street dance as well. So really, if we pay attention to where these particular lovely movements are coming from, we also have to see who's been erased for us to borrow those movements and put them on the mainstream screen and see how they've come to our bodies. Right. So if we actually trace that path of movement, we see that the very people who bring us, the very movements that bring us the most pleasure in the nightclub, are people who are not allowed into the nightclub, who are not even imagined as being citizens of the nightclub. And so, again, following dance, following aesthetics becomes a way of doing political critique. And all of that is functioning in the nightclub in ways that I think we don't always expect.
That's really provocative, and it makes it, you know, it's like one of those explanations that once you point out, it's just so obvious, but like I hadn't seen the world that way till you put it into words, and then I was like, oh, of course. Like,
but I'm not saying we shouldn't do those movements, you know.
Right.
And I think that that's really important, is like, but I think that the nightclub is actually a place to engage and try on and mess up and have fun and make worlds. And so I think I'm also trying to be capacious, because the people I write about are in fact lonely and struggling and sad and get a lot of pleasure out of trying on new movements to feel sexy in ways that the everyday world, and especially their workplaces and sometimes their homes, don't want them to.
And, you know, speaking of people having fun, this is something that you and I have talked about in the past, and you've written about it elsewhere, but there is this, like, link between fun and research, or pleasure and research, and I'm sure you've heard this a lot, that your project is, you know, like, so much fun. and I'm sure it does get irritating at times, because often this comment is made with a very mocking tone that upholds some kind of false binary, you know, like, oh, what a fun project, as opposed to a serious one that is going to make a difference or is like overtly political or some such. I was curious to know how you as a researcher think about fun and pleasure in and off research.
Yeah, it's a great question. you know, I think that in a lot of ways, the book is working very, 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 very hard to tell you, look, politics are happening here. Look at all this movement and style and ishtyle, and so much is happening, but look, here are the politics, right? And this is work that I felt like I had to do in order to give the book seriousness, because I was worried that it would look too fun, because people, when I tell people about the project, they say exactly what you said. They say, oh, that must have been fun research. And it's working on the assumption that research should not be fun. But it's also it's imagining the researcher as not having a body. They're thinking of researchers as people who sit in archives and forget and don't have bodies. But when you sit in archives, right, when you're sitting and working all day, you get body pains and aches. When you sit and write for hours, your body is actually involved. And if we don't take the body seriously in research, whether it is, you know, we'll actually damage the very tools that allow us to enter, whether it's an archive or a nightclub, right? So I think we have to take our bodies really, really seriously in research, and consider the body's pleasures and fun and restorative care for the body in all of those ways. But also sitting and reading some old-ass documents is very fun. You know, you get to laugh at the old spellings of things. You get to be scandalized by the ways, by the gossip that people were sharing in letters. You know, there's a lot of joy there. But yeah, I had a lot of fun. And I also was body shamed often. And I was, people laughed at my drag and my femininity and told me I wasn't a good drag queen or that, you know, and I felt undesirable a lot of the time. Like going to the club is hard. And it was work, right? And I made myself again vulnerable in those ways. But I say this early on in the book that I'm not ambivalent about nightlife. That it can do both, but it is actually a really magical place. Mm-hmm. And I'm feeling its loss, and I'm feeling its absence in social distancing land. And so I fully embraced the fact that my research was fun. I want it to be fun. I want my next research project to be fun. I want to have a good time because this is my work and my career, and I don't want to be bored by it.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds fair enough, honestly. But also, I think a lot of the conversation around embodiment and research emphasizes injury, pain, harassment, or suffering, right? And we are encouraged to write about those things, but I'm yet to come across, I mean, apart from the awesome special issue that you'd written for called Maza, I'm yet to come across much work on fun as a method, I guess. And the way you talked about dancing and how it helped you make these, or it enabled or made possible the fieldwork relationships was a great start in that direction, I think. But thanks for being candid and honest through the book. I really appreciate it. It was, as they put it, hashtag goals.
Great. You know, and I didn't feel like I was performing my vulnerability and exposing myself. I mean, this was just really the gift that other people had given me. You know, they taught, being in the field taught me a lot about how my body moves and what I'm conscious of or not. So it was field work. It wasn't just these moments of me pouring myself out in order to be vulnerable. It really was just part of the dialogue that was emerging with me and the folks I was with.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that comes across really clearly. This has been such a great conversation, but before I let you go, I would love for all of us to know more about what you're working on currently and what we can expect to read by you in the near future.
Yes. So I am working with two very amazing colleagues, Kemi Adeyemi and Ramon Rivera Cervera. We've been editing an anthology titled Queer Nightlife, and it should be coming out next year from University of Michigan Press. And the content in it is just beautiful. It centers non-Western and Black Indigenous POC takes on nightlife all over the world, all over the U.S. And North America, and is organized in the shape of the night. So we start with getting ready for the night, and then inside the club and on the stage at the show, and then after the night. So the chapters are arranged to follow the trajectory of the night. So that's the Queer Nightlife anthology. I'm currently working on a short book called Decolonized Drag that is coming out from Warscapes, that thinks about how drag has been folded into capitalist, has been occupied by whiteness, capitalism, and strategies for reimagining drag in other ways, in unexpected places. And then my next monograph that I'm trying to invent and make comes from my obsession with being an auntie and all my own aunties, and it's called Ontologies, Queer Aesthetics and South Asian Aunties. And that's my next new exciting venture that still feels nebulous, but very exciting nonetheless.
Yeah, and for everyone listening, please do follow the Instagram account Ontologies for some great auntie curation. all right, Kareem, Yeah, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I think you can expect lots of Kamala Harris anti-memes coming. They've started already, and yeah.
Well, on that note, we'll let you go. But thanks again for taking time out to do this. It was such a great book to read, and I'm sure it's going to do really, really well. So again, congratulations and all the best with whatever you're doing next.
Thank you.